This podcast is brought to you by MITEX, the Massachusetts Innovation and Technology Exchange, the region's premier association for thought leadership, technology trends, building business relationships, and professional training and development. For more information, go to www.mitx.org.
Hey, get your fresh bizcast here. I'm DC Dennison, on location in South Station, Boston. While I'm here, maybe I'll get a little information about the place. I noticed there's an information booth over in the corner of the terminal. Okay, that didn't work. The guy behind the counter at the information booth seemed almost afraid to talk to me, maybe because he needs clearance from Homeland Security, I don't know, before he talks to anyone with a notebook and a microphone. Fortunately, though, I moved down a few doors to Clark's Turn of the Century Saloon, where bartender Sal Brancato was happy to give me some background on the place, and I'll tack that on to the end of the bizcast. But first, I'm going to be talking to a bunch of Globe reporters. Jen Abelson on her close encounter with Gillette CEO James Kiltz, Peter Howe on innovative concrete and cell phone tours, and finally Hiawatha Bray on IPTV, a new kind of television that leans on technology borrowed from the internet. First up, Jen Abelson. Jen Abelson, you're just back from a Gillette shareholders meeting in Delaware to consider the purchase by Procter & Gamble. And you did us a favor by bringing back your digital audio file. One of the things I thought was the most interesting was when he addressed compensation. Why don't you set up how that came up and what you think we should listen for there?
Sure. Well, as part of the deal, Jim Kiltz, who's the chief executive at Gillette, stands to receive up to $165 million compensation package. And it's huge considering he's been at the company for only about 4 or 5 years and has gotten a lot of flack from shareholders at the meeting and also from even institutional firms that watch these sort of deals have made comments about it. So, you know, we wanted to ask him why he thought he was worth $165 million and what he's done for Gillette. So we tried to find that out.
All right, let's listen.
Well, my compensation has been a matter of public record since I joined the company back in 2001. And we've turned the company around. We've taken in the compensation is performance-based. We've turned the company around. We've created almost $20 billion of value, and I make no apologies about the compensation.
Jen, that was interesting. I noticed listening to the digital file that he also came around to that topic again. Explain how that happened.
Sure. Well, the interview had ended, and I went up to just shake his hand, and he wanted to talk more about the point. I guess he felt he did not make it clear enough about why he deserves his $165 million in compensation and wanted to expand on it. So.
Okay, let's listen to that.
Yeah, I guess the other point I'm making on the compensation question to ask is, you know, and I've commented on it so many times, I hate to belabor it, but, you know, it was approved by the board of directors, outside consultants, it's published, and it was totally based on performance because the compensation, a small part of the compensation, a relatively small part, is related to change of control, which was developed in 1999 before I got here. And about two-thirds of public companies have that same change of control. Two-thirds of Fortune 500 companies have that same change of control, and the compensation was based on performance. And because we performed so well is why I got compensated well. If we would have performed like the rest of the industry, my compensation would have been like the rest of the industry. And, you know, I never feel good about apologizing for outperforming the industry and making a lot of money for shareholders, and I happen to make money as part of that. And I think that's part of what incentive compensation is all about. And when I joined the company, I knew I was taking a risk of joining a company that hadn't performed for 5 years. And on the other hand, I didn't want a large fixed compensation that you could get with things like restricted stock that would vest over time. So what I took is more risk-based compensation called stock options. And because our stock outperformed the S&P, I think the Boston Globe had a wonderful chart that they published, 79% up versus 4% for the S&P 500. And
that's how I wound up getting the compensation I did. And I have trouble apologizing for that because the shareholders did very well, as I said. So just to get that on the record.
Boy, that's interesting that he felt he had to come back to it again. Do you feel like now he's put that to rest? Will he have to deal with this over and over again, or is everyone going to move on at this point?
Well, I think they're probably moving on. I think it's somewhat Tibet, although once the final deal comes around, and depending on whether Kilt stays on for the full year that he's agreed to, that it might come up again when he leaves. But, you know, some people don't think he's going to stay on that long. But I think the whole issue of executive compensation and sort of exorbitant deals that are offered is something that's always going to live on.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot. Peter Howe, you've just gotten the very first innovative concrete story into the Boston Globe. So give me some background on that.
Well, DC, it's only been 2,000 years that humankind has been building with concrete. So sooner or later, the Boston Globe was bound to come up with a story worthy of the business and innovation section, which we did this past Monday. And you definitely, if you're listening to this on a podcast, stay away from the fast forward button, because precast concrete is going to have you at the edge of your seat. The nature and depth and complexity of the kind of creative innovation that is just rampaging through this very exciting, very vibrant industry. But seriously, the story is, I was up in Melrose, Massachusetts, looking at only the second of its kind installation of a new system of precast foundations. If you think of a building site, typically the first thing you do when you're building a house is dig a hole and put in a bunch of forms and pour wet mix concrete, let it sit for 2 weeks, then take the forms off, and then you can start building your house. The idea with this is that the foundation arrives on the back of a truck. It's giant slabs of concrete that have been made in a factory, in this case at a company called Chase Precast out in North Brookfield. And so it shows up, and it's these are panels that can be up to about 30 feet wide. And so you can literally, between the foundation and if you're using modular components in the house, which the people building this place in Melrose were, you could literally go from a hole in the ground to a 90% finished house in 5 days.
Yeah, I hadn't realized that there was this sort of two-week curing that had to go on with concrete. I always assumed that they, you know, the concrete trucks came in, poured the foundation, and then sort of the next day they moved on to the next level of, you know, building up. But I guess that was really quite a holdup.
Yeah, and it's so much of construction is driven by the old maxim that time is money, and
yeah.
So anything that you can do faster is, it's better for the builder, it's better for you, the homeowner, and the financing and mortgage costs that you're carrying. And the builder that I talked to in Melrose, Dan Bandar, he's already got his next 4 or 5 houses in the works using the precast foundation. The first one of these Chase precast systems was done in Fairhaven, Massachusetts last month, and the builder there, Dana Nilsson, is also looking at doing another half dozen or so. It's not, as I stress in the story, it's not the very first of its kind. There is a company in Pennsylvania called Superior Walls that has been doing precast foundations for about 25 years. And in fact, you might have seen an episode of This Old House with Bob Vila, where they redid a place in Carlisle, and they used a Superior Wall foundation. But it's their closest plant is Schenectady, New York. So they have done very limited amounts of work in Massachusetts, unless you're really willing to pay a lot of money to haul a foundation several hundred miles.
Yeah, so concrete is kind of like the dairy industry. You have to be close to make
true.
It work.
That's a good way of putting it. And as we get into in the story, there's a surprising amount of innovative stuff going on in the world of precast concrete, this house foundation system that we mentioned. And then also things like, if you've been at Logan Airport anytime recently, they're adding three new levels to the main parking garage there. They're managing to do that without ever closing the garage, and they're also managing to do it without having any space at Logan for construction staging, because you know what a mess that place is. They have these precast decks that come in, and they go straight off a truck onto the garage. They're just lifted by crane, and so they will be able to keep the existing garage open and expand it at the same time.
Yeah, that struck me when I read it in your story about, you know, I thought, yeah, what a mess it is when you've got concrete
you know, basically liquid coming in. You know, you're in this construction environment, and you're dealing with cranes and huge blocks of granite and brick, and all of a sudden you're dealing with liquid and trucks that have to keep the liquid liquid. And it just seems like that if you could, you know, if somebody could come along and say, okay, you don't have to deal with the whole cement industry in its liquid form, that could save a lot of time and money.
Yeah, yeah. And you will pay more, definitely, for doing this. And where you save money is really by saving time. In situations like another thing I mentioned is the new hotel that's under construction next to the convention center in South Boston. There are 790 rooms, almost all of which their floors and ceilings are being built with these precast panels that are raised up. And doing that, a lot of that work, if you were pumping concrete up 12 or 14 stories, it's doable and it gets done all the time, but it's tremendously complicated. It's messy, you know, as you talk about. So it really is, it can be a lot easier to do this. And there's one pretty amazing example that I mentioned in the story about a bridge in New Hampshire where it took them a grand total of 8 days to install a new bridge over the Lamprey River in Epping, New Hampshire. They paid more, but from the standpoint of the state, if you look at all the savings in time and inconvenience for motorists, the fact that they were able to have this bridge out for just a little over 2 months, 8 days of which was spent actually building the new one after they demolished the old one, it becomes pretty financially compelling to do things that way.
Yeah. Hey, Peter, thanks for bringing concrete to the Globe. Hiawatha Bray, you recently wrote a front-page story on IPTV. What does this acronym mean to television viewers?
Well, it could mean quite a bit, but in order to understand why, you have to understand what IPTV is. And basically, IPTV stands for Internet Protocol Television, and it's the application of the packet-switching method of delivering information that we use on the Internet. It's the application of that to television. You start getting into the whole complexity of what packet-switching means, and we don't have to get into all of that. But the basic upshot of it is that you can have a network which sends out just the programs you want to receive, and your television system, your cable or your telephone wire in this case, doesn't have to cope with all the stuff that's being broadcast at any given moment. All it has to deliver to your house is the particular program you want to see.
So you're kind of web surfing for TV.
You're web surfing for TV. It works on the same principle. Just as when you go onto the Internet and you go to the website you want to look at, and you're not downloading all the other websites out there. They might as well not exist. Mm-hmm. You're just downloading the one website you want to look at. That's what IPTV is going to allow. Now, today, when you have cable television, that cable is carrying every program that they've got.
Right.
And that's why it's hard for a cable system to add a new channel, because it's already filled up.
Right.
All the programs are already moving down that channel. With IPTV, the only thing that comes into your house are the channels you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that you can add dramatically greater varieties of programming, because anybody who can get a video server and hook up to the network can now send you his TV shows. One of the consequences of IPTV is that the amount of stuff we'll be able to look at should become, well, almost infinite for practical purposes, limited only by your ability to produce some video and get it hooked up onto a server. If you can do that, people can say, I want to see this, put in the correct command, and they'll see it.
The encouraging thing, too, is that the companies behind this are not cable companies. They're companies that want to get into television but have so far been kept out. Microsoft, phone companies. So they really are motivated to get this into the marketplace.
They are very highly motivated. You're exactly right. One of the key reasons this is such a cool idea is because the phone companies have been fighting over this issue for years. Now, we're all at home using DSL. I know I do. I use DSL to get my broadband. People forget that DSL was originally developed by the phone company as an experimental technology for delivering television signals.
Oh, interesting.
They were thinking about doing this. Yeah, I should have put that in the story.
Yeah.
Actually, this was back in the late 80s, early 90s that they were working on this, but they decided that it really wasn't cost effective at that point. But today, with video compression technology combined with DSL, you can take a really high-quality TV program and just squeeze it so tight into such a small package that you could now if you had DSL on the phone line, actually shove TV programs over a standard phone line. Hmm. And that means that they can finally compete with cable, because the coaxial cable used by the cable companies has a much larger data capacity than those old-fashioned copper phone lines.
Yeah,
that's
right.
What's kept the phone companies out of the cable TV business.
Yes.
With IPTV combined with digital compression, they're getting into the TV business, and they can actually do it. One of these phone lines will be able to handle maybe four or five channels of television. And the cool thing is that's enough, because the only channels that will be coming in at any given moment are the ones you want to look at.
Yeah, yeah.
None of the other channels are going to be coming down like they do on the regular cable.
Right,
and that's because of the IP part.
Yeah.
With the packet switching network, it picks the packets that the viewer wants, and all the other packets on the network just go whizzing around, and they have nothing to do with your wire and your house.
Yeah.
They don't come in.
Yeah. Huh.
So IPTV just dramatically improves the ability of anybody to deliver really a vast array of television programming. And by the way, there's no reason why the cable companies couldn't also offer IPTV. It's just that they'd have to rebuild their whole infrastructure, and they're already in the business, so they're not rushing to do it.
Right, they are not motivated.
They have no motivation.
Yeah,
the phone companies, though, they're sitting here going, this is our way in.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's why SBC, and to a lesser extent Verizon, are pushing this.
So what does it mean for providers? For, I think one of the things you bring up in the story is that, you know, content providers are also, this could liberate them to a certain degree.
Oh, absolutely, because precisely anybody who can get access to the video servers can now get on TV. It's going to be a while, I guess, before we see exactly how it works out, but in theory, a company like SBC or Verizon can set up a portion of their server capacity and just say, all right, this server we're going to use to connect to anybody else who wants to offer video programming, and we'll charge you X amount of money for access to this service. And if you want whatever these guys are showing, whatever it is, it can be children's shows, it can be porn, it can be it can be political propaganda, it can be sports like you've never watched before. If there's somebody out there who wants to look at all the cricket games that are being played in India right now, today it just doesn't make economic sense to show cricket in the United States.
To have a cricket channel.
To have the cricket channel.
Yeah.
In an IPTV world, it's common sense. I mean, cricket's on in India all the time.
Right.
Just get a feed onto the internet of that programming, hook it up to a server in the U.S., and just anybody who wants it, he pushes his remote, he gets cricket.
Yeah. Huh.
Or anything else he happens to want to see.
So good news for cricket players.
Good news for cricket
fans.
Good news for fans of just about anything. Because if you're prepared to pay for it, I mean, for example, the companies offering cricket would undoubtedly charge for it. They could make money off of it.
Yeah.
They would just say, do you want access to the IPTV cricket channel? Fine, it's $5 a month. Send us a check.
Yeah.
And bingo, you start getting cricket whenever you want cricket.
Hmm.
But the thing is, just as that is now available to some extent on existing cable or even satellite TV, with IPTV, there's no limit.
Yeah.
Anybody at all who appeals to some little audience can produce his own video programs and say, here it is, charge it. I'll charge you so much to look at this, bring it in, and you can start watching it.
All right, great. Hey, thanks a lot.
No problem.
Thanks for listening, and check in next Wednesday for a brand new BizCast. Or better yet, subscribe and have BizCast automatically delivered to your computer and MP3 player. And now, as promised, a word with Sal Brancato, bartender at Clark's Turn of the Century Saloon in South Station.
So, Sal, how's business?
Generally speaking, I think throughout the years, this has probably been the slowest, I would think, as far as tourists is concerned.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Huh. So, what impact has the cancellation of the Acela had on business?
I think, you know, people now might be thinking about, you know, perhaps getting an airline ticket and flying to New York sometimes.
Yeah, right.
Where in the past where people would come through South Station
and
pick up that train to go to New York, you know?
If they've been spending 3 hours on a train, they arrive at South Station thirsty.
Oh, they come here, they're thirsty. You can tell. Especially if they're aggravated or whatever. The first thing they do when they come through that door is they want a nice cold draft beer.
So what are your peak times? Like when, if you think about South Station as being kind of like, you know, tides coming in and out. I mean, when do the crowds swell? And
generally speaking, like Monday through Friday, this is where this place here is very, very busy, obviously, because that's when we have most of the volume of people coming in. On the weekends, it's quiet, obviously, because the financial district is closed.
Hey, thanks, Sal.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right.
Pleasure talking to you.